I'm Tom Downing.
I'm Adam DiCarlo.
And welcome to Before the Break, a podcast for actors
by actors.
Brought to you by Working Actor Pro.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Before the Break. I am once again joined by special guest host Julian Gavilanis. This week, we have a wonderful guest, and we can't wait to meet him. On the big screen, you've seen him in the film Bros. On TV, he's appeared on Manifest, Gotham, and The Path. And on Broadway, he's been in Harry Potter and The Cursed Child. Please welcome to the show the very talented and award-winning actor, Jamel Dobson. Hello, Jamel.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well. I'm like still waking up, but I'm good.
Thank you so much. We're so excited to chat with you today. Where are you currently?
So I'm currently in Ashland, Oregon. I'm performing at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. I'm doing the Three Musketeers, where I play Alexander Dumas. And I took over the role of Orsino in Twelfth Night.
Amazing. How's it going?
I mean, it's different. It's definitely different than anything that I have been used to. It's the second longest contract I've ever been a part of.
How long is the contract?
I started rehearsals in mid-March. It's supposed to go until October, but actually this is my final week at the festival as I'm making to do another project that I can't really talk about just yet, but yeah.
Are you a Shakespeare guy? Has that been your thing? Is that something that you've been doing for a while?
So the interesting thing is, this is my first time doing Shakespeare in over 15 years. The last Shakespeare show I did was Romeo and Juliet, where I played Lord Montague and the Apothecary, which are not huge roles at all. No.
You had to dust off that complete works.
Yeah. And so I was like very, very nervous about how I would do. But like I said, I took over the role after an actor had to leave due to personal family reasons. And so I was like, all right, here we go. But like the cast is so warm and welcoming. And the thing that I've learned is like, if you know how to act, if you know how to, you know, just what is your objective? What are the beats within this scene? Then you should be able to do Shakespeare. I think we get so daunted and intimidated by the language. I know I certainly did, for sure. And then you realize that like, oh, this is what he wants. Like you may not actually understand every single thing. It may not necessarily pertain to how a modern mind thinks, but I'm like, the gist of what he wants is this. So as long as you get to that through line, then you should be good. And so that's kind of how I've worked. So,
and can I ask you, when you take over a role and you're not necessarily anticipating something like that is going to happen, what was the time turnover of like having to learn and then rehearse this whole role that you essentially like didn't know was coming, right?
So thankfully, I mean, because
that's what would scare the shit out of me.
Oh, well, I mean, thankfully, this was my first time going on because I was basically the Orsino understudy. So I already on the role. So I wasn't terribly stressed about that. And I had attended a few of the rehearsals and whatnot. So I felt prepared. And at least the great thing about Orsino is that he only appears in four scenes. So it wasn't like this huge daunting task where, you know, I'm not playing Viola or Cesario. I'm playing Orsino. So it's like, okay, I get to focus on these four lines. And as the understudy, it's like, well, a lot of the grunt work has already been done for me. So I just have to add my own spin to it, to how I see the character. And so that's kind of what I've done. So I felt like a lot of the grunt work was actually already done for me. And like I said, the cast was so warm and welcoming that by the time I had, it's weird because I'm performing on the Elizabethan stage for both of those shows. And the theater holds about 1,200 people. 1,200 seats. And so you're there, and I'm like, I'm used to being on this stage, but the first night I was on as Racine, I was like, this is weird. I was like, I'm used to being on this stage, but I'm like, it was a complete out-of-body experience because I'm like, I'm in different clothes, totally paying attention to what's happening, and I'm seeing Shakespeare in front of all these people. Wait, stay in it. What are you doing? You know, that's kind of how my brain was at first. But once we got through that first performance, it was fine. And then they called me, because the original actor, he was on for a little less than 2 weeks before he had to leave after the show opened. Then they gave me a heads up that I might have to step in. And then they were going to do this whole hunt for another actor to take over the role. And then I think it was our interim artistic director and the director of the piece saw my first performance and were like, why doesn't he just take up the role? I was like, he actually did a wonderful job. And so
we're not going to audition again.
Yeah. I was like, no. Yeah. So it felt good. It felt really good.
That's awesome. Well, Oregon Shakespeare Festival is huge. So congratulations. That's an amazing booking.
Thank you.
So Jamel, let's start from the beginning. Where are you from originally? Growing up, were you exposed to the arts at all? Did you find it later in life? What was growing up like?
Yes. So I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My mother was a police officer. She's retired now due to health reasons. And my dad, may he rest in peace, he worked during the day as a maintenance worker at a hospital. And then at night, he would rent film equipment at the local cable access network. And he would make sort of low budget independent films, and he would cast his friends and local actors. And
because
my mother often worked nights, I would go with him on these shoots, and he would sometimes put me in the shoots. And so I remember like being on a set, quote unquote set, since I was
Dad,
like,
what are we doing?
But like, the thing is that, like, you know, he saw that I was taking direction even at like 4 years old, and like I wasn't running around and like causing havoc. You know, I was like fascinated. You know, I think there was one day I can remember vividly where like I was bored and like thirsty, and so, and it was snowing one day, and I just was like, you know, like as like the sun is dropping, I'm like, you know, like absorbing like the snowflakes, whatever. That's the only time I remember like acting out on set. But other than that, like,
that's amazing.
Yeah,
it was. What kind of projects were these? Like, what was what? And why didn't it act for like his? For him to actually make a career out of it, and what was going on there, and like, and are those movies available still?
Oh God, I hope not. God, no. Oh, yeah, they were just for like the local cable access channel at the time. I think at the time it was called PCTV. I don't even know if they still exist anymore, but they were just like these. Some of them were mostly like action based or like thriller based. Projects. They were often shot in black and white. And I don't think they're, I pray to God they're not available. But I couldn't have possibly have been good. But it was just a great training ground for me. But I think back then I thought that being an actor was synonymous with being like a movie star. And it's not until you get
right.
old and realize that the two are not necessarily one and the same. I mean, hell,
at all.
You barely have to know how to act anymore to be a quote unquote celebrity. So it's changed. I don't know where I was going with that, but yeah.
What a great like entrance into this business though, through your dad, recognizing that he actually had another job that supported him, and then he was able to do this thing on the side, which was probably just through passion. It must have given you such great affection for the world in which it is created, and a realistic understanding of it outside of just like that idea that you said, which is just like synonymous with movie stardom and stuff. It's like, no, this is people make movies and they, you know, put them on cable, and it is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, and he later went on to, he left Pittsburgh when I was about 16 years old, and he moved to LA. His friend was already kind of establishing himself out in the LA market, and they worked on a film called Love and a Bullet that starred Tretch by Naughty by Nature. It started circulating a lot on like BET networks and stuff like that. And then he did another project that I can't even remember the name of it anymore, but it was starring Mark Wahlberg and Lou Diamond Phillips. And so he did a lot of what I call like B-list action movies and stuff like that. He worked a lot with like rappers. Like I remember one day, I'm aging myself now, where I was, it gone into a Blockbuster video store, and I was like looking for, you know,
I love Blockbuster.
People don't understand. People don't understand how.
Like, you're like, we have to pick something. We've been in here for an hour.
Yes, and it was like, an event.
And now we just scroll on our TVs.
Yeah, but it was fun. And so, like, anyway, I like remember looking around for like, you know, something to watch for the weekend, and I saw this like, DVD box of like it had Exhibit and Busta Rhymes on the cover holding like machine guns and whatnot. I was like, this looked like some shit my dad would do. And I told him, like, it is! Oh my God.
That's awesome, man. That's cool.
That's crazy. That's amazing. You went to LA to try and do it.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
I mean, and he never got to be like this huge filmmaker or whatever, but at least he did it. And not, you know, looking back on it now, I'm grateful that I had the example to just go for it, regardless of what the outcome may be. You know, we may not always be millionaires or household names, you know, but we at least have the gumption to go and try it and just see what happens. You just never know how things will pan out.
But I think people forget to realize that a movie made and put out and like actually available to be seen is a fucking miracle. There are so many moving parts. So like, you know, to discredit the fact that like he, you know, like didn't just do it, and like because he's not some well-known huge celebrity director or filmmaker, like it holds no ground. It's just like he did it. He continued to do it. And that's human, and that's the majority of filmmakers in the marketplace, you know? Like they're not the 1% of people. And it's the same with actors, you know. I think people associate actors and filmmakers just like, oh, cool. Like you mean Darren Aronofsky or David Fincher or Tim Burton? Like, it's just like, no, it's like I'm Julian Gavilanes. Do you know you don't know me, but I'm doing it.
Yeah,
and it's cool, man. It must have given you really great insight into the business, into your own like into your own way of thinking about how you wanted to participate in that. I assume it was just a really healthy approach too. Maybe and maybe not.
It definitely was. But I also will say, just to piggyback off what you were saying, I remember it reminded me of the time that somehow my dad was able to get my sister and I backstage on the set of The Piano Lesson when they were filming in Pittsburgh. And I got a chance to meet Alfre Woodard and Charles S. Dutton. And I came across an actor by the name of Lewis Myers, who, if anybody is familiar with the show A Different World, he played like the chef character on that show at the little school cafe or whatever. And he went up to me. I couldn't have been no older than like 14 or 15, but he came up to me and he was like, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, I want to be an actor like you. He said, okay, well, you got to study for it. You got to train really hard, go to New York and do theater. You know, you got to train for it like you would to be a lawyer or a doctor. And those words never left me. And that stuck with me. And so that's why I knew I wanted to start my career in New York. Now, granted, I had done theater and have been doing theater for a lot longer than I thought I would be, you know, but, you know, I just turned 42 this past Sunday. And I thought,
happy birthday, man.
Thank you.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. But, you know, you always have this vision of how you think your life is supposed to be at whatever stage you're in or whatever. But I have to say that I am at a place of complete gratitude for just working and having stuck it out all these years. I know so many friends of mine that I went to grad school with that, you know, they've completely left the business. They left the business after 2 years, you know, and somehow I've stuck with it and still continue to work, even amidst of a writer's strike. And I'm like, I'm still working in some capacity as a writer. And that is a gift, a huge, huge blessing.
That's amazing. Would you say what your dad did was that kind of the planted seed for wanting to get into this and wanting to be an actor and seeing as a little kid, seeing actors around you?
Oh, for sure. He definitely planted the seed, nurtured the seed for sure, because he was the kind of dad. He wasn't the kind of dad that would watch like football games on the weekend. I remember doing like major household chores, like, you know, mowing the lawn or, you know, cleaning the house top to bottom or washing the car. And then every weekend we would either go to the movies or rent a movie. So movies were always a part of my life, always. And I remember like in all kinds of movies, like, you know, horror films, B-list horror films. I knew who Chow Yun-fat was way before he made It to America, Jet Li, and all of these people, you know. And he just exposed me to so many different art forms and genres. And I'm so grateful that I had him as my dad to show me all of those things, you know. And
that's amazing.
It seems cool too, because you had a reference of the business through a father who was doing it, but this guy that you met, this actor on set, was the one that really inspired you to move forward with it. It sounds like your dad was just kind of like, look, I want you to be here if you want to be here. But like, did he pressure you to like, you never hear of parents that are like, you need to become an actor. Like, you know, they're like, you need to be a doctor, you need to be a lawyer. But parents are never like, hey, like, this is really the move that you should make. Was he like, hey, be careful when you were coming into this business and kind of getting like stars in your eyes, like, this is a tough business? Was he like thoughtful about that stuff, or was he kind of just like, just come and make up your mind for your own self and see what happens?
I think it definitely was more of the latter. I think everyone in the family knew I had some sort of talent. They just didn't know how to go about it. Nobody in my family ever really pursued anything within the industry.
When you're an adult, you don't know how to do it.
Yeah. You know, like,
there's no like streamlined thing. You can just go, oh, if you want to be a professional actor, you go do this, you go do that, you go do that. And then it literally doesn't work like that.
Right.
And like every, you know, like Q&A you ever go to and someone who's very green asks that, and, you know, the person being asked is like, that answer doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Because I'm here. My movie just came out or what, but how I got here is not how the person sitting next to me got here. Mm-hmm. It's different for everybody. Yeah. Everybody's story is different.
Yeah. And also back to your like concept of like stick-to-itiveness, I think a lot of people forget to realize when they say, oh, cool, like, well, this movie took me, you know, 8-9 months to film, shoot, post-produce and get it all done to the screen. It's like, no, it actually took me, I'm 37 and it took me 37 years to get to this place. Like, it's all like a whole life's work towards this thing, and sticking to it when you don't want to stick with it anymore. The reason why people drop out 2 years later is because it sucks. It's because it's so hard to think that like, I'm going to eventually break through this barrier that's in front of me that seems impossible. Like, how am I going to climb over this mountain? This isn't, it's impossible. And like, again, like I talk about it a lot on this podcast. It's like the delusion that we kind of like have with ourselves, that we think we can move beyond to get to the other side. And it's always the common thread with people who wind up making a career out of this thing, is that they did that. They stuck through it. They were delusional enough to believe that they could. And then somehow we're just like, I stayed like, you know, past 10, 15 years and just started to like happen. And it wasn't any like a giant boost bump. It just slowly, progressively moved forward on this like a little tiny trajectory that was going upwards, and now I'm here. And it's like, yeah, that's always the case. So good for you, man, for like continuing to do that. I imagine you had some many, many years after, like, you know, getting out, like, out of your dad's movies and into, like, the real world of what you were trying to do professionally, where you were like, okay, this is crazy. How did you navigate all the difficulties, and where did you go?
Oh my gosh. I mean, let me just first of all say that first 2 years fucked me without lube. Like, not even. I was like, what the hell?
2 years out of college?
Out of grad school. So, because here's the thing.
Where'd you go to grad school?
I went to grad school at University of Iowa, which I'm sure is on nobody's radar. They have a great playwriting program, but they weren't necessarily known for their acting program, though their acting program is great, and I still use their, you know, skills to this day. And the first show that I booked out of grad school was actually a show that it was the show that led me to that school in the first place. Because I remember I went through, I'm not sure if people are familiar with the URTAs, like the URTA, I think University Resident Theater Association auditions. I don't know if they still had it, but back in the day, back in my day, they had a bunch of schools from across the nation would go and audition. You know, you'd be at, like, I want to say, like, a Hilton Hotel in Times Square, and you would audition, you know, with a total of two monologues for a 3-minute audition slot. And then at the end, you get a slip of paper where all these different schools would call you back or not call you back or what have you. Whoa. And so University of Iowa was one of those schools that ended up calling me back. And they brought me in. And it's all, the whole thing right now, as I talk about it, it feels like a horrible Harvey Weinstein setup, because they are all these interviews set up in these hotel rooms. I was like, yes, what could possibly go wrong here? You know,
not like a ballroom with little, like, actual not hotel ballroom, rooms.
Actual hotel rooms. Now, granted, though, they each were accompanied by, like, there are two people from the university. So each school was always had, like, two people within it. So I guess that was their way of safeguarding. But yeah, it was a very strange process that I don't think would ever
fly. I feel like that would happen now. I really don't.
Yeah. Whoa. It happened back then, for sure. And so anyway, University of Iowa was one of the people that called me back, and they were not on my radar at all, but they gave me a list of the shows that they were doing for that year. And one of the shows happened to be a musical called The Seven. And I saw the words New York Theater Workshop, in association with New York Theater Workshop. And I was like, I don't know anything about this theater, but I'm getting into this school, I'm getting into this play in this school, and I'm getting this play at New York Theater Workshop. And all three things happened.
Wow.
And yeah, because we were doing The Seven. I was playing a different character called, because it was based off of Seven Against Thebes, but it was a hip-hop musical. And so I was playing the brother Eteocles, and I remember there was word that the director of this piece that was doing it in New York and the cast director from this theater were flying into town. I was like, that's all I needed to hear. And so I immediately was like, use that rehearsal as my audition. And before I knew it, like a couple of days later, the playwright was like, would you be interested to do the workshop? And so I was able to do the workshop that summer, and then cut to my final year of grad school in the fall. I flew out to audition for the New York production, stayed with the playwright for a couple of days. I wasn't fully confident that I had gotten it because they kept putting me through the ringer. And now I realize that they were just testing me to see if I was ready and, you know, could do the role. But I left there feeling like, oh God, I just wasted my plane ticket. They're not going to cast me. Oh God, they hate me and all of this stuff. And then just as I was about to leave his house to go to the train station, he was like, oh, you about to leave? Oh, let me give you a ride to the train station. And so on the way to the train station, he was like, so congratulations, man, you got it. I was like, oh my God. Wow. Cool. But you think that, like, your life is going to change after that, because you're like, I had grad school, I just booked this great part in this off-Broadway show, it's the home of Rent, I'm about to blow up.
You're looking at houses to buy, you're thinking about what car you're going to own.
None of those things. I'm like, it took me another 5 years before I even landed an agent. You know, it just took a long time. Yeah. Yeah. Things for me just took a while. And I'm not entirely sure what I was, but
For a lot of people, you know, I think a lot of, I don't know, maybe a lot of people think, oh, I'm going to insert prestigious school name and there's going to be a showcase after and I'm going to get repped from that. And then getting a rep immediately means I'm going to get into rooms and then blah, 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 blah. And sometimes you get done with school and there's like a 5 year period where you're like, how do I fucking do this? Like, how do I a lot of times when you're in school, and we've talked about this a million times on this show, they don't necessarily give you the best, advice would be the word, as to how to go out into the real world with no school or no, you know, safety net of school, and how to go about the process of getting repped and starting the, you know, they don't really tell you that.
Oh, 100% facts, for sure. That's exactly how I felt, where I felt like, yeah, you've made me the best artist that I can be.
Completely.
But you have not explained actually navigate the business and be an actual businessman. You know, and you hear, like, in school, like, them teaching you, you have to think of yourself as a product, which I'm like, what do you mean I'm a product? I'm a person. What do you mean? You know, but, like, it does kind of help you a little bit to understand how you fit into the
puzzle. You have to make yourself marketable because if you're looking for representation, the person who's the rep needs to go, okay, who is Jamel? What does he do? What
can I cast him now?
Yes. What, you know, what does he excel? Is he a comedy guy? Is he a musical thing? You have to make yourself marketable for them to go, yeah, I'm going to add you to my client list. And I truly think that by bringing Jamel on to my roster, he's going to book, which is going to make me the rep money. You know, it is it's a relationship. It's a symbiotic thing. And so for them to go, I think Jamel is super talented and he's going to book, which means money for my business. You know, you have to show them those things that make them go, yeah, I want to sign you. I want to work with you. You have to make yourself marketable. And that process of hustle for a lot of people can take years and years and years. And I think that part, the hustle part of, all right, what do I need? Headshots, a reel, build up my resume. I need a website. I need, blah, 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 you know, all those things so you can go, here I am.
Yeah.
They don't teach you a lot of that shit. And so many times it's just talking to friends and they're like, why aren't you on this website? And I'm like, oh, I didn't even fucking know about X, Y, and Z. Or why aren't you doing this? I didn't even know about that. And so, you know, you just sort of like live and learn over the years, but it is fucking hard.
It is. It is. And trust, I've definitely gone through those days. I remember I was cast in Classical Theater of Harlem, but at the time they weren't necessarily the most well-paid company, I'll say that. And so I remember, you know, still living in Washington Heights at the time, and I didn't even have enough money to get a Metro card, which at the time was like $250. Mm-hmm. And I literally walked from West 179th Street down to West 43rd Street because I did not have enough money for a Metro card. And I remember asking the director if I could possibly, and he ended up giving me like $50. But I was like struggling. Like those early years, you're just like struggling, trying to make this dream happen. It's like, yeah, I'm working, but I'm not really able to like support myself.
That's the craziest about theater, man. It's like you can't be a stranger to being broke, you know, even if you are working. You know, like you get a job and it will consume all of your time to where you actually can't even get another job and supplement your income. So like, unless you have $350 rent, which doesn't exist unless you're living in a broom closet and Washington Heights, like I also have done, it's just like, okay, cool. Like, you know, you're like, mom, dad, I'm working, you know, like guys, hey, look at me. Like I'm doing this like off Broadway show. And they're like, oh my God, that's so cool. Like you must be like doing great then. You're like, well, I'm actually calling because I need to borrow some money. It's just like, I don't have any. They're like, what are you talking about? You're like a New York theater actor. And it's just so, it's so disheartening, you know, because like there's just not, and still, I think, you know, there's just like such a small amount of money distributed for actors in that theater world. And it always makes it so crazy because then you go on and you do a movie or a television show like you've done many of, and you're just like, wait a second. I did 2 days on this TV show and I got paid that much.
Right.
And I did that show for fucking 6 months and I got paid just the same. Wait, yeah. Hold on.
Right. Hey,
it's more TV. But artistically, you're just like, you know, it's such a weird like contradiction of itself because you're like, wait, I feel so much more fulfilled doing this artistic work in the theater space, but like, why don't these things add up? And so it just like, it messes with your head. I think, you know, to like go backwards a little bit, it's like knowing the having the wherewithal to be like, okay, I need my website, I need my things, I need all these things to make myself a person in this business, to make myself viable. And I think the thing that you wind up getting to is an actual mindset of, okay, cool, I need to like get away from this idea that I can be anything and everything. Bring myself back down to what I can be and should be for the purpose of being viable, and then realize it through doing these jobs that I can expand myself out of that. So let's not, so it's like reducing yourself to build yourself back up, not to just be like, oh, like I need to dumb myself down so that I can get jobs in film, television, theater, wherever, but like recognizing that you are one in a million and knowing you're not the shit, because I think everybody that comes out, especially to New York, and I'm sure in LA, wherever, it's just like, I was the best actor in my Oklahoma play in my high school, and so therefore I'm going to go out to New York and I'm going to be the best actor that ever was, and then they're slapped in the face, just like, oh my god, I'm a fucking loser, you know, and realizing that like, okay, I'm not a loser, but I also am like not, I'm in a huge pool of people that are just as, if not more talented than me. So I got to work my ass off. I got to figure out what my niche is and then expand out from that niche and like grow and build. And it seems like you've been able to do that in a really, really giant way. But it's like spending all those years doing that theater and being broke and being like, what? Like,
how did you come out of it?
I mean, I think the first few years that you're in New York, you're just kind of like throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks. You're like,
totally.
Okay, yeah. What works? What lane do I go in? You know, because that's the thing. When you go to grad school, and I was just talking to somebody about this the other day, I'm like, you go to grad school and you learn like Shakespeare and Chekhov and Ibsen, and all this stuff. And then like, I remember one of the first auditions I got was like Donkey and Shrek. And I was like, what the? I didn't train in musical theater, and I remember like going in and I did, you know, some song that wasn't even in my correct key because I didn't know how to like transpose things down to my appropriate key at the time. And they're like, do you have anything else in your book? And I was like, book? What is that?
Yeah.
The Bible? Like, what do you mean? I didn't know what you were talking about. I was like, what?
And they said, thank you.
Yeah. So I was like, what? You know, so
it's
catching up to your colleagues and to your peers because they have done the work. And you realize that, like, okay, especially being an actor of color in this industry, in New York, doing theater, you feel like you have to get at least some musical theater chops under your belt because 90% of the stuff that is out there that is geared towards actors of color are musicals, at least back then. It's slowly gotten better, but it's still very much so that. And so it's like, have at least a few good songs that you know that you can perform at a moment's notice, know how to pick up an 8 count and, you know, go from there. And I've done that over the years of like taking dance classes and like taking the singing lessons to try to strengthen my instrument and all of those things to help to broaden your opportunities and broaden who you are as
completely
an artist, you know. But it was figuring, a lot of it was figuring out where exactly did I fit within the industry. And you know, interesting looking over my career thus far, it's been like in one of two ways where I either am like playing like the gay best friend or the drag queen or something of that spectrum, or I'm playing the cop, the construction worker, you know, the tough guy, whatever. It's always in those two.
That's a big range.
Yes.
Like drag queens and construction workers.
Yes.
Like the village people.
So after, you know, those years of kind of finding your way and getting the ball rolling and the hustle, what started to turn things around where you were like, all right, I think we're moving in a good direction and we're on our way now? You said it was quite a while before you got repped.
It had been 5 years before I got repped, and then I was like working, but at that time I was still, I felt like I was finding the majority of my work on my own. It's like, yeah, I had a rep, but I was doing a lot of that stuff on my own. I think a lot of actors can attest to that, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. To be honest with you, I feel like things didn't really truly turn a tide for me until, I did the show 1 and 2 at the new group. It was a show that featured three Black men. It was an absurdist play written by Donye Arlove, who I loved and has written a number of amazing plays. But he's a playwright that I had always wanted to work with. And it was a play that talked specifically about the crises and epidemic of gay or bisexual Black men that were infected or will be infected with HIV in their lifetime. That's the statistic is 1 in 2, every 1 in 2 here bisexual Black men will have this. It's a really daunting, crazy thing. But I remember the conceit of the show was that the three of us actors had to learn every single, there were about 15 or 16 roles in the show. And on any given night, we could play different tracks. So we weren't necessarily assigned a character. We just had to learn the entire play. And based off of, you know, like the reaction, you know, we would discover who was the main Dante character and who took on all the other other roles, other 14, 15 roles. And that show, I felt, changed my life and career like indefinitely, because anyone who saw that was like, how did those men do that? And that's also, I think, how Gail Keller, who was the cast director for Gross, found me and saw me and brought me into that. And that changed.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Was it like the subject matter that you connected with so strongly, or like the undertone of the show that just like made you recognize yourself as an actor even more? Like, was it just full, all well-rounded? Like, what was it about the show that just like tapped you so strongly?
It was all of those things. It was a subject matter that was very close to my heart. It dealt with my community, but also just being a character actor, I loved the challenge of playing different roles and not knowing which role I would have to take on any given moment. It was a tour de force without like you either sank or you swam. There was no other way to put it, because there was no intermission. It was like the set was designed in this white box. It was made to look like almost like an insane asylum or something. And,
what year is this, by the way, Jamal?
That was done. We did that 2019 through January 2020.
Oh, wow. Not too long ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause then like the following month auditioned for Bros, and then the following month the world shut down. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so interesting, man. It by no means is it a comparison, but like I did the Normal Heart. Are you familiar with this play?
I love the Normal Heart. Yes.
Normal Heart, and I got to play. It was a really small production, but I got to play Ned Weeks, and I'm a straight guy, and I played it, and it resonated with me on such a deeper level because of somebody who stands up to something so strongly and has no ability to back down. Like it's like the inability to back down from something. It really kind of posed this question for me in my acting of like, if I can buy into something so purely and like really stand up for it, I don't have to necessarily act. I just have to believe what I'm representing. And again, like even as like a man, I was just like taken by that performance and by that script and by the subject matter in a way that like was so profound for me and made me believe for the first time in my life that I think I can do this. And maybe that was what was happening with you, even though you had had a million different signs from all the different shows you had done. And like, sometimes it just takes that one moment to be like, oh man, this is really connecting in a way that it hasn't before. And that's a testament to writing, right? And like really quality playwriting or screenwriting, whatever it is that you're working on. But sometimes when you tap into that stuff, it's like it's bigger than you, and it's powerful in a way that like kind of transcends the what acting even is for us. And that's so cool that you had that experience, man. Like I'm sure it was equally as painful as it was powerful for you.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's definitely the most challenging show I've ever done. It was the hardest show that I've ever done. You know, and I'm a Virgo, so I'm a perfectionist by nature. And so I'm always trying to like get things right, get my work right. And it's like with that one, I really had to just free myself and let go. I feel like that's what that process was like for me. But I also recognize that every single role that I have had led me to that. And I think every single role kind of informs you as an artist and makes you a much richer artist, you know, because you get a chance to just do all kinds of different things, you know. And I'm so grateful for my journey. I feel like my journey has been very specific to me. I don't know too many people that have had the kind of career that I've had, and I'm very grateful for that. You know, yeah, it was a very enriching experience.
You know, you come off of an experience like that, which I'm sure must have been such a high. What was that like, that ending? And then the, you know, having that high of coming off of that show and then the world ending, and out of that came Bros. What was that whole journey like?
So the interesting thing was that I think I auditioned for Bros like, I want to say late January, early February. And then I was getting word through my reps that they really liked my tape and they had sent it on to the next phase and then the next phase. And then March came and the world shut down. And I was like, okay. But then somehow, even during the pandemic, I was still kind of finding work. We had done a remounting of the play 1 and 2 for Playbill. It was a live stream that was in support of Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS and the Legal Defense Fund at the time. And so we were able to still work, and more people who hadn't seen the off-Broadway show were able to see the live stream now. And then that seemed to like generate other opportunities in a weird way. I was doing other readings and was even a part of like a musical podcast. And so oddly enough, like I was still finding opportunities, even though I wasn't
That's amazing.
A lot of money, but I was still acting opportunities, which was great. And so then when the world finally did come back, and then I got word that they're still interested in your tape. I was like, oh, I forgot all about that. I was like,
What tape?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that movie. Fuck, yes. Great. Yeah.
Yes. I was like, oh, okay. Okay, great. I'm still in the running. Fantastic. And I found out on my 40th birthday that I booked that. And then prior to that, found out that I booked Harry Potter in San Francisco. And I was like, this is wild.
We just talked about this very, very difficult, treacherous journey that it is to become a professional actor. And at one point you left school going, all right, I have to go do this. And how am I going to do this? And years later, you turn 40 and you book a major motion picture and a play,
largest plays.
Of like one of the biggest, you know, fiction franchises in history, like back to back, coming out of an enormous pandemic of just blackout of new media, basically. Yeah. Like, yeah. That's incredible.
It was kind of crazy. And the thing about with Harry Potter was like, that was my third time going in for it. I remember going in for, I think it was year two of the Broadway cast, either year two or year three, I can't remember, but making it very far into the process and got to audition in front of the full creative team. And I was like, and I just knew, I was like, this is mine. This has to be, mm-hmm. you know? And then when it didn't happen, I was like, what? But then they called me in again for the first year of the San Francisco company. And I thought, again, this went well, didn't happen. And so then by the third time, I was like, okay, whatever. Because I also was working, at the time I was working the overnight shift at a hotel in Midtown. And so I was running off of like an hour and a half of sleep before my audition.
Oh, I remember being
exhausted, but I just went in and was just like, I think because I was too exhausted to be nervous that I just ended up doing my best work and was like, all right, here we go. You
know? Sometimes when you just throw that all out and there's not a, when your audition has no desperation or kind of ulterior motive, you know, and you just let it all go and do it. That is so many times we've heard on this podcast when lightning struck. And it's so many stories like that of like, I was absolutely wiped, or I was in such a rush to do something, or, you know, whatever it was, but it was like, I just let all that go and I just did it. And that was the one that was like, bingo.
Yeah, exactly. That was exactly it.
Always feels like as soon as you relinquish the desperate need to get the thing you've always been wanting, and it's almost like just shift in your brain space. You're like you forgot about the Burroughs thing. You forgot about, like, it's just like, you just have to like actually, and I think a lot of times, even for me, I'm okay, I'm just going to like act like I don't care. It's like, no, you got to actually like get rid of it from your head. And as soon as you can just let it go and walk away, not always, this isn't the formula for it to work, right. But like, it feels like it's a real rule of thumb. Like once you actually stop caring and stop like putting all of your energy and focus into it, boom. Because like for every person that talks about like this moment for them, it's just like, yeah, I expected it when I was young. I was like ready for, I was ready to be famous. I was ready for all this shit to happen. And then you go through the ringer, you get fucking put into the grinder and get your ass kicked. And then you come out the other end being like, fuck, dude, how am I going to do this? And then you go through 5 years of just like, yes, I'm still doing it. Here I am. And boom, like, wait, what? And it takes you by surprise. And it's so like heartwarming that is how it happens, because you truly do have to just like let it go to like let it happen.
I have to say, it's a reason why I kind of like self-tapes, is it takes a lot of the like the edge off of going to an office and being in front of the people. And when it's just us at home doing it and I throw up the backdrop and like I set it up, I'm just really thinking about the scene and I don't have all the shit in my head of like, I'm meeting the people, I'm going to the office, I'm waiting to be seen. Like all of that stuff kind of creeps in. And when it's just me at home, I'm like, yeah, let's do the scene. I'll send it. I'll throw the sides away and we move on. You know, it takes I get what the role is and I get what the, you know, the project might be, which I've gone on for things that I'm like, this would be insane. But the actual nerves of going to an audition, all of that is gone. And I feel so chill at home. And I'm like, yeah, I would love to get this. This is like the biggest show on television.
Maybe I need to adopt more of that.
My sides away. If I hear back, cool. If I don't, I hope I get another one. And that's just like, it's just a mindset thing. And that's what one aspect of self-tapes that I've really enjoyed is it just it brings me down to earth a little bit, because I'm one of those people who the ritual of going to the office, meeting that, you know, being in the room and trying to be, you know, that like sociable version before you even do the fucking scene, all of that gives like a little nerves. So when all that's removed from the equation, I'm like, chill, let's just do the scene, toss the sides, move on, you know?
I totally see your point for sure. I have a love-hate relationship with self-tapes because I'm not the most technologically savvy person at all. And so, you know, I hate the fact that like with self-tapes, you have to become not just the actor, but like the lighting designer, the sound designer, the backdrop. And it's just like so much stuff. And then you have to like transfer it. Don't we transfer or do that? It's like, oh, Lord, it's just so much stuff. Whereas like with, I actually do well in the room, and I miss that connection of getting that direct feedback from the casting director. I feel like I actually, in a way, have thrived in person and have missed a lot of in-person auditions. And maybe that's part of what helped, too, even was like, even though the job that I'm currently on right now, I booked partly through a self-tape and partly through in-person dance audition. So that was a slight hybrid, but like I feel like I do better actually in the room because I'm able to feed off of the energy of the room. I know how to, because I already work in theater, I know how to play to a crowd. So I'm like, I can just feed off of that. They can see the presence, whereas sometimes when I do self-tapes, they don't understand my size or stature or see all 6'4" of me.
You're that tall.
Yeah, I'm 6'4".
Oh, wow.
So you may not get all of those things within a self-tape. I don't know. So I actually miss a lot more of in-person auditions. I'm like,
I'm one of those who doesn't want to go back to going to the office.
I think you're probably the minority, Adam. I think like, and I think, you know, it's good. And
don't get me wrong. I could not imagine doing that for musical theater. I don't do musical theater. So I will say in that aspect, I would probably be absolutely the opposite and be like, fuck this. This is not how musical theater auditions should go when you're like going to a track and like music is a totally different thing. Yeah. So for just TV and film, though, that I really like just doing at home and then being able to pick my own best takes and be like, and knowing as you're doing it, that was the one. Whereas when you go to the office, you do it once and you're still kind of on your nerves and they're like, great, we're done. Bye. And you're like, I feel like that one single take when I walked in the room was not like the thing that I want to be passed on. So then I get to pick them. And unless it says otherwise, I'll give you two or three with a little variation. And I just sort of, we've said this on the pod before. There are so many things in this business that you have no control over whatsoever.
Yeah.
A lot of it being the casting process. However, since the pandemic and really leaning into self-tapes, I have the control to give them the best version of my tape, which has never been the case, where you are literally what they see and what they're going to cast you from, I, the actor, have the control of. And I think that's fucking amazing and rare to be like, I'm going to pick the takes. I'm going to send you the, and you know, if it's like a lot of scenes, I'm not sending three takes of every scene.
Right.
I'm not sending like 15 files and they're like, Adam, calm the fuck down. Yeah. But if it's like a good, you know, like a guest star, like a really good guest star role with like a lot of meat to it, I'll do like two really solid takes that are a bit different because we don't have the feedback in the room like we used to. So it's like, look, this can kind of go two ways and this is kind of, I'm just going to give you a little variation, you know, but I can be in charge of that. And that for this industry, for us, is incredibly rare. So I just like to, you know, at least have control over one thing, you know?
Yeah, but, for sure.
Don't,
is your point for sure. You may have converted me slightly.
But anyway, yeah, anyway, back to Harry Potter. What was that like? That show is insane.
That show's so good.
It's great. It was great. Yeah. It was a lot of work. A lot of work.
When I saw it here, I was overwhelmed. And then the summer before COVID, I auditioned for the two lead boys, and I just remember going, I'm already exhausted by the potential rehearsal and doing the show. It's so physical.
Yeah.
It's so much.
You really do have to train like an athlete. I often compare it to playing basketball for 3.5 hours in a three-piece suit, dress shoes, and a cloak, and you've summed up what it's like working on Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. It is that exhausting. But at the same time, the bond that I've made with the cast, we are family now. Like, we still have like a WhatsApp group chat that is going on for like 2 years now, and I just love those guys so much. Because you go through something that not very many people on this planet have ever gone through, an experience that, you know, and especially being in San Francisco, where many of us were implanted there, and, you know, we had to like really live there. And so we got to experience something that was very unique and different. And it was cool. The Broadway version is obviously like ideal, because it's like San Francisco doesn't have the infrastructure to support a long-standing show like Harry Potter. I think that's why it could have possibly ran longer, but San Francisco,
like audience-wise. Oh, okay, yeah.
Audience-wise, you know, because San Francisco is a tech town, and many people have moved out of there. It was also a city that was hit very hard by the pandemic, and so the numbers of the audience size were not that huge compared to Broadway audiences. Yeah. Even though the theater itself is gorgeous, and the way they redid the theater when I was stunning, and you're just like, I can't believe I'm a part of this massive undertaking. It's crazy, but all that said and done, it was an incredible, magical experience that I wouldn't have traded for anything in the world.
How much time did you have to get into it before you went on?
So I think the rehearsal process, because we were in the year two of that company, I was cast in the year two of that company. I think we had about 2 or 3 weeks of rehearsal, standard rehearsal, and then it was like a month of tech. I remember the tech process was the long part.
Oh
yeah.
My God.
So like, because a lot of the members of that cast had already done year one, there were like maybe 12 of us that were joining this year two cast. And so we kind of had to play catch up with everybody else, but we moved very fast until it got to the tech process, because it's a very tech heavy show, obviously.
There's so many
magic tricks, so many stunts, so many stuff that I'm not even allowed to reveal, but like, you know, it was just like incredible to be like, wow, okay. Like, again, I'm a part of this massive undertaking. I'm like a cog in this machine, but a really big, universally known machine, which is really cool. So
did it just feel like you were kind of shot out of a cannon into it? And like, when do you ever feel like settled into that role or like into that play? Where did you ever feel like it kind of was able to go onto autopilot or anything, or was it always just like,
autopilot, you will hurt yourself or somebody. So no. But
be on it.
It's all about maintenance, because I feel like you have to train like an athlete. You really do, because just doing so much and running around that stage.
That show's insane.
Are you able to like still experience new moments in the show when you're acting, when it's something that's that technical and it's that like put together?
It's a challenge. Don't know if I'm allowed. Well, because of the roles that I cover, because I was the understudy for that one for Sorting Hat and Bane, And those characters only appear in one scene each. So the challenge was making those characters memorable. Mm-hmm. That was a challenge. And I would not have had the same concerns, obviously, if I was like Harry or you know, Ron or something. That's a totally different experience, you know. But to make these sort of secondary characters just as valid and important, because you do need them in order to move the play forward, it was a challenge, but it was something that I, you know, was happy to do and looked forward to doing whenever I got to step into those roles. And then like with the main role that I had, I was like the, what do I call it? He was like the Voldemort world general. I don't know if anybody has seen the show, but in Act 2, they open up in Voldemort's world. And so to open up the show.
Like one of the Death Eaters?
Not the Death Eaters, but there's like a huge dance section that happens that opens up Act 2. And so I was a part of, I led that. And that is a challenge of itself, in that you don't have any lines, but you have to make this character memorable and powerful and stand out in a way that it's like his moment. That's a challenge. But it was fun. I mean, it was a lot of fun, very exhausting, but fun.
Yeah, man. I mean, what a testament to like humility as well in trying to like take those roles and make them memorable, but also like recognizing what they're meant for and recognizing that you're like a cog in the wheel, as you said, and really just participating in that machine that it is. Like, what a cool experience, because it's just, it almost seems like it's just like out of body. It doesn't even feel like it would be an acting thing. It would feel like it's just a, like going to the Olympics or something. It's like, it's such a different
going to the
thing.
Olympics every single night.
Yeah. It's just, it's like, it's not something that I think a lot of actors get to experience. And I wonder like how that translates for you now into like maybe what you're doing here with the Shakespeare thing. I'm sure stamina is fucking wild.
Oh yeah. Oh, for sure. And it reminded me too, cause something else that I had forgot to mention earlier was I had worked with the Bill T. Jones Ernie Zane Dance Company, and I started working with him because he choreographed the first show I did in New York called The Seven. And to get the opportunity to work with his company dancing and taking up free dance classes with that company also helped to inform this, which then also helped to inform this, you know? And so it's like, again, like every project that you have, it helps to, it's like, oh, I can pick that up. I can pick up
it's that adding job. To your toolbox. So like when new things go up, you go, oh yeah, that's not completely foreign to me. Even though, you know, I'm sure they make room for you to get better, but at least there's something there that you can go, yeah, this isn't wildly crazy for me.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So yeah, it all helped. Everything helped feed into the other. So it was good.
And it will continue to do that, right? Like this show that you're doing right now will continue to feed into the next thing that you do and then the next thing. And it's just the sticking with it and being like available to what comes next and not having like managing your expectations. I always find that that's the best thing that we can do as actors is just manage our expectations and know that like what will come at the right time, but just to be like prepared for the things that are already in front of you and to take advantage of those things. And you learn along the way. Like if it weren't for this Harry Potter, you wouldn't know how to do this thing, to do that thing with this thing. And maybe that's why you became an asset to this new thing that you have because of that one thing. And maybe it was like one of the things that your dad taught you along the way when you were on set with Busta Rhymes or whatever, you know, you saw in that movie that you like inspired a little spark of insight. It's just like all of these little things, when you think about it, that's why it all comes back to like, well, it actually wasn't a 6-month process. It was a 42-year process, you know, and it's going.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, back in grad school, there are two reasons why I went to grad school. One was obviously to become a better actor. I wanted to come out very transformed. I wanted to go to the gym and look different and sound different. I wanted my speech to be clearer and crisper and all that stuff. And then like, And I was hoping, the second reason was I wanted to be the leading man that I had always envisioned for myself. I wanted to be this leading man. And so I remember there was a time where the head of the acting department, he was going around and saying what everyone's character types was. And I was like, what's my character type? Hoping that he would say, like, you're a leading man. He was like, and he paused and he was like, you're a character actor. And I was like, what?
Hey, character actors work. Character actors work.
Yes.
But at the I'd be time, like, thank you. Love that.
What I heard was, you're not attractive enough to be a leading man. That's what I heard in my head.
You're like the most attractive guy I've ever seen in my life. So no, get that shit out.
Listen,
God.
At the time, character actors to me meant like Jason Alexander from Seinfeld.
Or right.
Seinfeld or something like that. Like they were always the sidekicks. Yeah. I was like, what do you mean? I was like, I don't understand, you know. But now I realize, looking back on it, he probably was kind of to, first of all, help me to expand my range and know that you are an actor who has range, who can do so many different things. But I
drag queen cop, not a lot of people can say that.
Yeah, totally.
Being openly gay, I think he knew that the struggle for me would be different. It would be more challenging.
Right.
And I might have a easier time going into the character actor lane than necessarily forcing myself into the leading man lane. And so it's interesting now to be 42 playing two lead characters, but, you know, in different capacity. They're obviously two very different roles. I mean, at least how we're presenting Alexandre Dumas, it's kind of a modern take on Three Musketeers, and he kind of has a rock rapper edge to him. And so I'm getting a rap and dance and sing and all of these stuff, you know, and use all the tools within, you know, my developed toolbox that I've got, you know, been able to gather all of these years. But at the same time, I'm still the leading man. And then in Casino, it's like, that is your standard leading man in this Shakespeare play. And something I never thought I would have the opportunity or even ability to do. And now I'm doing it. So it has been a blessing. This job has been a blessing for those reasons. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Jamel, what a career, what a life. It's, you know, it's funny. You mentioned the thing that you thought really began to thrust you. And that was only in 2019. That was not too long ago. Yeah. And my goodness, since then, you've just been on a roll. I think you're, you know, 42 or not, like, you're just really starting to hit your fucking stride, and it's going to be so cool to see where you're going from here. Cause I think you've got the ball rolling now. And so it'll be cool to see what you do.
Also, you could probably still be in like Glee as a high school student as well. Just for reference, like
as a senior,
maybe a junior even. Man, your age range is like 17 to like 35. Man,
thank you. I will take it.
Jamel, do you have any? You know, you are currently at Oregon Shakespeare Festival. We know that. Do you have more things in the pipeline coming up that you can talk about?
I wish I could talk about it,
okay,
but I
copy
can't.
That.
But but do know I will be returning to New York Broadway stage. I will say that.
Yeah, dude. Nice.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
You can't talk about it because it's not official yet. I thought it had something to do with like the striking or something like that.
No.
This just hasn't been announced.
It hasn't been announced yet. Yeah.
Dude, that's amazing, man.
Congratulations.
That's so cool.
Thank you.
You owe us your tickets now.
Like an imminent announcement, like in the next.
I'm sure it'll probably be announced sometime in October, I would imagine.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Wow, man. How does that feel?
So excited.
It must be nice to go from one thing to another thing and like this.
This is very rare.
Sorry, I have to leave my contract early. I have to go to Broadway. Booked and blessed.
Yeah. Yeah, seriously.
I'm sure the actors here don't hate me.
No, man, I'm proud. It's like, it's nice to know that it happens. You know, it's like, that's the real takeaway. It's just like, hey, fuckers, stick with it. And like, this can also happen to you. You know, it's not like, oh my God, like you don't deserve it. We just got done talking for an hour and 10 minutes about how you fucking got your ass kicked, you know, this whole entire time to get to this place. Yeah. And there's nobody more deserving than you to be exactly where you're at. You know, it's like all of your struggles, all of your experiences are such a testament to like why you are where you are. And I think it's also has to do so much with your attitude and your humility and who you represent, you know, as just a person. And it goes so far. I think we get so stuck in being like, I'm an actor. And so therefore I like forget to be a person because I'm an actor. I'm so focused on like getting my next job. And it's just like, don't you realize that being an actor is like being a person? The more experienced you are in the world, the more grateful and gratitude, the more like things you do, the more hobbies you have, the more life you actually are able to exhibit, the better you're going to be. And it seems like you just have been doing that all along, man. You're like, you are a representation of exactly where you now are. It's, you are where you are because you are where you are. I say that a lot sometimes. And it's like, I think you don't say it to yourself, do it, because it's like, oh yeah, I am proud that I have got to this place and that I do like been blessed. Like sure, it sounds shitty and like hashtaggy and stupid, but it's like, bro, you did this. Like you did this. And that's incredible. You're in the game and like you made it.
Wow.
And it's fucking cool. Absolutely. And thank you for sticking with it long enough.
Jamel, people want to find you online. Where can they do that?
I'm on Instagram at Jamel Dobson, all one word. And I think on X or Twitter or whatever they're calling themselves now, at Jamel_Dobson.
Awesome. Jamel, this was such a pleasure. Thank you for chatting with us. It was so wonderful to meet you and can't wait to see what you have being announced soon.
I know. I'm excited. I'm like super eager. I wanted to go online and tell us.
Thank you guys so much. This has been an unbelievable chat, an unbelievable opportunity. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Privileged. And have a wonderful rest of your run with Oregon Shakespeare.
Thank you.
Festival.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very privileged to meet you, Jamel. It's really cool, man. Keep doing what you're doing. It's working.
Thank you. Have a good day, guys.
You too,
man.
Bye.
Nice.
That was wonderful. What a good kind of episode about perseverance, because I mean, you know, from MFA to doing that show in 2019 that he said really like, you know, got it going. Obviously he was working. He has like TV stuff under his belt. He's done loads of theater, but you know, he's 42 now, and man, the last few years, it's really just lit up for him. So it's just a testament to, you never know when it's your time, you know? I think as actors, it's so easy to like look at what age we are and go, oh, well, you know, I'm doing stuff, but I'm not quite where I want, you know, and like, have the temptation to tap out because of what your age is, which isn't really how this works. There's so many, you know, award, like huge film actors who got started in their 50s.
Yeah.
And now they're in every fucking movie and, you know, they're incredible, but like, you know, they were a school teacher until they like, you know, someone recommended getting into acting and, you know, they started in their 50s. There's no time to this thing, which obviously is very, you know, can be discerning sometimes when you're like, okay, I need like a really steady job.
But, yeah, totally, man.
You know, you look at Jamel and it's like, there's no time to this thing. He's 42 and it's like, he's just getting going, you know? So it'll be cool to see everything that comes from here on out, and you know, he has an announcement next month, which will be super cool. And
totally, he really does feel like he's just scratching the surface, and it is, man. It's like sometimes I talk to people like him who have done so much cool stuff, and I'm almost just like I expect them to feel like a. I don't know why, but like almost like arrogant celebrity of some kind that like can just like talk themselves. And it's just like, I almost like, because he's so humble and because he's so sweet and kind of like, surprised by his own career and success, you're just like, oh, he like gets brought down like this human level. And then you're just like, oh yeah, you just are a good dude. You just are like a good human being that happens to work really hard and be getting ahead in this craft because you have stuck with it. And I do the same thing where I'm like, well, Samuel L. Jackson didn't get into his first movie until he was this long. And it's like, I'm holding my breath. Like, okay. And then it's like, bro, even when you're 50, like if you're still acting and you're 50, you're doing something right. Like if you're still in it, despite what level, like just keep going. If you love it enough, you're going to, and you'll find success wherever it might be. If you know how to like make your way there. And he's just such a great, I loved it, man. I think he's so cool. And what a handsome
fucker.
I can feel insecure about myself.
he is such a sweetheart.
So
excited for him and everything he's done and what he's got coming. And it'd be cool to see where his career goes.
Totally, man. I'm following.
All righty. You can find out more about Before the Break and how to become a working actor at workingactorpro.com. You can follow us on Instagram at Before the Break Pod and Working Actor Pro. Follow us on Twitter or X or whatever the fuck it's called at B4. That's the number for the Break Pod. You can follow us on TikTok at Before the Break Pod. Check out my stuff at AdamDeCarlo.com and give me a follow at ThatAdamDeCarlo. You can check out Tom's stuff at TheTomDowning and follow him at I'm Tom, by the way. And you can follow Julian at Julian Gavilanes. Don't forget to hit subscribe, leave a rating, and write a review if you like what you hear. Check back next week for an all-new episode with an all-new guest. See ya.
Bye, man.
You've been listening to Before the Break. The hosts are Tommy Beardmore and Adam DeCarlo. Cover art by Amanda June Boucher. Music by Benjamin Sturley. Before the Break is recorded live from Los Angeles and New York City.